Down south, they say it's the economy, stupid. Up here, we say it's the economy, eh? And this is Political Economy Radio, a progressive take on economic issues in Canada and beyond. My name is Michał Rozwodski, and welcome to the show. This week, I'm very happy to have an extended interview with Jane McAlevey. Jane is a well-known U.S. labor organizer and author. During the 2000s, she worked for the SEIU, organizing mostly service and care workers. Much of her work was in right-to-work states, places where the labor movement has had limited success in new organizing. Her strategies led to strong unions that engaged workers, even bringing hundreds out to regular bargaining sessions, and using other very innovative tactics. These new unions also helped to fight and win political and community campaigns. Her book, Raising Expectations and Raising Hell, is an account of her time as an organizer and repository of ideas for other organizers. Jane is now a postdoctoral fellow at Harvard and has just about done her second book, which goes further into her thinking on organizing today, Organizing to Win. I caught up with Jane after she gave a speech at Unifor's National Organizing Conference. Here's to hoping Canada's labor movement can learn some of the lessons her work offers. Without further ado, my conversation with Jane McAlevey. Well, maybe I'll start with this. I've heard you argue saying that labor today doesn't really face, you know, some kind of external crisis sort of circumstances, but a crisis of strategy. That things are bad, but, you know, if you look at the 30s or earlier or later, you know, working living conditions weren't rosy, and we still saw huge mobilizations and a stronger labor movement than we have today. If we have a crisis of strategy, what are we missing? What are the strategies that will work today?
Yeah, let me just say, it's an important question, and I should clarify a little bit. I think that there are external factors. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't want to dismiss that the changing nature of capital has made things very difficult. Obviously, trade agreements and globalization. Like, so it isn't that, and I think I do, as a self-criticism, I think that I sometimes come off like completely dismissive of like structural conditions. So I don't mean to be completely dismissive. I mean to put an emphasis on that which we control.
Right.
Right. Yeah. So it's like, I'm fine to talk about globalization till the cows come home. We know it's there. We know it's a problem. The question is, what are we fucking doing about it? Right. It's
exactly.
Like, so to me, the issue is, I want to focus on a debate that we can actually make real change to. And I think that if we do change our strategy, we actually can win again. I think that's just as a backdrop. I think it's like why I often pound so hard on the question of internal movement failure is because it's in the movement's control. We're not going to change the trajectory of global trade tomorrow. What we can do tomorrow is set up as a movement and decide we've got the wrong strategies, right? Yeah. So I think part of, you know, to me, I think the general thing is this. There has been this recognition in the last 20 years or so in the USA in particular that, you know, we have a crisis, that the conditions are very difficult, that the employer offensive is very difficult. All true. I completely agree. The problem is what happened in the U.S. labor movement in the last 20 years is that the decision to look for what was called additional leverage, right? Mm-hmm. How could we bring more power to the fight? How could we back off the employer? The decision was completely crazy. And the decision was to walk away from workers in the workplace and to develop these very sophisticated, heavily staffed, and by the way, staffed by, no offense, but, you know, very well-educated white men mm-hmm. with big college degrees who literally, when they were hired at SEIU and sometimes at the AFL-CIO, depending on who was in charge, literally, this was so indicative to me, they were given written tests. When you went into the strategic research departments, they were given written tests in the application process. Okay, first of all, that was just crazy. But second of all, they were four-hour-long financial spreadsheet reading tests to hire someone to think strategically in the labor movement, which to me sort of summed it all up. It was like, okay, do you know how to talk to a worker? Yeah. Like, can you go actually just talk with workers about what they know about their employer? That's a very different approach, right? So the development of the corporate campaign, which is what it's called, you know, in the States, I think has been a colossal disaster. And it's an evolution in some ways of taking the agency away from workers at every level inside the labor movement. So to me, the core difference, the key strategic pivot we have to make is we have to go back to, one, having a ton of faith in rank and file workers, in the ordinary intelligence of rank and file workers, and we have to prioritize our strategy on teaching and skilling up and training tens of thousands of workers and how to fight. And that's what we stopped doing 20 years ago. So the strategic pivot is, look, organizing isn't rocket science. It is, by the way, a serious skill. It's a craft, right? You get better at it the longer you do it. You know, it's like you build a house. The first one, probably not so good. Your 10th house, better, right? Organizing is a craft. We have to build an army of people in the field who can actually contend with capital at the local level, whether it's in political elections, whether it's in the workplace, whether it's... So to not talk to workers and to have a strategy that fundamentally avoided workers for 20 years, that's what we need to change, and that's what we can change.
I think there's an aspect here of, you know, really relearning how to talk to people and how to relate to them. How do we, as a labor movement, as a left, find a language that really speaks to people again and finds a way to relate to people, that relates to people, that isn't, again, mediated by the sort of, by the financial spreadsheets or by campaigns that just sort of go over people's heads.
Or by super heavy left rhetoric.
Yeah.
It's inaccessible to people, right?
Yeah.
Which we're really guilty of too. So, I mean, I think the first thing, I agree with you on this, but I think one of the first things is, even just conceptually, because I think semantics are so important, mm-hmm. we need to worry less about how we talk and worry more about listening.
Right.
Like, we stopped listening to workers. I mean, that's part of disregarding the sort of intelligence of ordinary people. Mm-hmm. We got this arrogant leadership team that came into the U.S. labor movement after 1995. I think arrogance was like the death of what happened. I mean, they just thought, we can do what others can't do. We're smarter than workers. We're smarter than everyone. We're so smart. We're so smart. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think we have to actually listen to people. And if you, like in the, what we call the seven steps to a good organizing conversation, if you look at that and then you think about what are the steps to a good organizing conversation, that's to a one-on-one, to a face-to-face one-on-one. It's sort of, it's a framework, I think, for how we could be talking collectively as well. Mm-hmm. And in the basic steps of an organizing conversation, it's 70-30, we say. 70% listening, one-on-one. And maybe 30% talking. And the 30% of the talking that we're doing is really agitational. It's a series of specific questions. It's helping people walk through a conversation where they begin themselves by the questions the organizer is asking in a face-to-face one-on-one. The worker themselves begins to self-analyze the crisis in their life. So no one walks up to them and says, let me tell you about the problem with capitalism. You know, your boss is really effing you, right? Yeah. Like, first of all, they don't need to be told that their boss is screwing them. Like, workers know their boss is screwing them.
They know.
But I think the framework of the conversation is so important. I think that people have to engage in self-discovery. And part of why face-to-face organizing and not tweeting and not Twitter and not Facebooking and not any of this crap, that's mobilizing tools. But organizing tools and an organizing conversation is literally about the process of self-discovery. Yeah. And the way the structure of the conversation is such that people begin to systematize and analyze what's going wrong in their life.
Right. So their own experience up to something that's actually broader. And then you can bring that out and get people together talking these ways.
Absolutely.
Right?
Yeah. But I mean, I think the key is that people have to experience and come to their own conclusion that there's something really profoundly wrong with the political economy system that we have, certainly in the U.S. And all of our assumptions are generally wrong about who's going to think what. And that's the self-discovery part. That's why it's so fun to do an organizing conversation with just a worker on the doors who you've never met. Someone gave you their name. You're talking to them on the doors. Mm-hmm. You know, you pull up, you're making assumptions, conservative, you know, something, politics, you know, see certain, you know, a bumper sticker that, oh, geez. Mm-hmm. And you get in there and it's like through the process of a good, long face-to-face conversation, the person, almost to a worker, you know, comes out pissed off at their boss, understands that their boss is connected to a bigger political system, and starting for the first time to think, ah, this is the key. Oh, I can actually do something about this if I act collectively. Like, to me, the main thing is that we have to get people to understand collective behavior and collective action. That's like the biggest challenge we have.
This made me think of things like Fight for 15 and movements like that, which in some ways I think that's kind of descriptive of that, because it is taking people and connecting them to something sort of broader. But on the other hand, and it's inspired similar campaigns in Canada. We have sort of Fight for 15 now here too. But in other ways, it seems to fall more on the side of what you would call mobilizing rather than organizing, right? We're seeing sort of some pushing of core issues, but not as much one actual union organizing coming out of it, or really, you know, like bigger collective structures. What's the tension between these goals and what's going on in some of these new movements, and how do they relate to what you consider really organizing?
So the entire focus of the next book, the one that I'm finishing now, is me sort of analyzing through a bunch of case studies what I'm going to call mobilizing models versus organizing models. And I think the Fight for 15 stuff is very much a mobilizing model. So, okay, here's the thing. We need to do lots of mobilizing. There's no question. It's just like the structure issue, right? Like, I don't want to get painted as being like anti-mobilizing. That's crazy, of course, right? We're pro-mobilizing. The problem is that there isn't any depth to the Fight for 15 campaign. So, I mean, really not any depth. It's like a joke. It's like, you know, we call it the Berlin Rosen campaign, right? It's like one hotshot media firm that's gotten, I think the estimate is 50, 60, 70 million at this point that SEIU has been paying to Berlin Rosen, to a media firm, to like create through social media the illusion of this huge movement. Okay, now in Chicago, they've got some real work on the ground going on. The original SeaTac airport campaign was a real organizing campaign. That's really the origins of, you know, they're giving a lot of credit to SEIU in Washington State for passing the Seattle 15, which I think we could have an endlessly long discussion about. But the truth is, the first real campaign that was what I call Real 15 was the SeaTac airport campaign. That was a real organizing campaign.
And workers led it. Yeah.
There's been unionization coming off of it. It's super powerful. And they won 15 now, right? Like, they actually got 15. They didn't get a phased in, staged in, very complicated. No one even knows if they fit in the formula or not. And it becomes 15 in 2022. That ain't 15 in 2022. They're not indexed, all the things we're winning. So this is part of the Berlin Rosen hype. It's part of the media hype about it. It's like, wait a minute. You know, I have a little Excel spreadsheet comparing the recent 15s. You know, and you look at the SeaTac one and the people who really started this, and that's the only real 15 so far. Everything right. else, there's phased in, staged in, they're not indexed, they're not, you know. So this, to me, the SeaTac was the sort of gold, wins the gold star here, and we should be looking more closely at that original campaign for what we should be doing. We veered way off it, and now it's mostly a publicity and social media campaign. And I don't, you know, it's great that people are getting a raise. So let's, like, I don't, let's not diss that, right? Like, a dollar an hour going up in New York now, whatever it is, you know, for a year until it gets to, okay, it's phased in. But hey, dollar an hour raise is a good thing, right? So there's no, so it's good. It's that it isn't also doing any deep organizing. And that, I think, is the problem. Right now in the US, I feel like, just having this conversation with a bunch of people from the climate change movement, where I was challenging them about organizing. And they were like, yeah, but, you know, the climate's going so fast, our job isn't to do the, you know, we're not the ones who are going to do the organizing. We're all mobilizing. Everywhere I go, every sector of the movement says, everything's so urgent, we're just mobilizing, someone else has got to worry about that. And it's like, at some point I said to a bunch of people recently, some younger climate change people, like, what the F are you talking about? Everyone in the world is like, well, someone else has got to be doing the deep organizing. Right. We're going to focus on the mobilizing. Well, that is the problem. Everyone is focused on mobilizing. And there are so few places. And I have to say, you know, I'm in Canada for this Unifor organizing conference, and I am impressed. I mean, there are very few places still where people are actually trying to figure out, how do we go have face-to-face live conversations that allow for self-discovery by the working class. There are, within the labor movement, there's not enough of it happening. But at least where it is happening, it tends to still be in the labor movement, whether that's right. in Canada or the U.S. So for all the criticisms, you know, that's easy to heap on the labor movement. For God's sakes, there's still real organizing going on.
And I think that's something that doesn't happen, right, through bombarding people with Facebook memes, because it's just your own. It's the same people seeing having that
so,
conversation.
You know, yeah, I mean, look, part of the big problem with the mobilizing model and the tweeting and the blah, 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 and the Facebook and all that stuff that I'm often so cynical about, and that I am really cynical now. So I'm gonna give that there are structural factors. I'm not giving on Facebook and tweeting, because I just think it's been actually destructive for our movement. So I think that the problem is that when we're doing just a mobilizing model and just a mobilizing approach, all we're doing is talking to the already convinced, and we're not doing base expansion. And the beauty of real organizing, the evidence for which I think is abounds, sort of like in the Nevada examples in Chicago, but real organizing is about focusing on people who are not yet convinced and not yet involved in our movement. And it's what we call focusing on the undecideds. And that's, we have to do several things to rebuild a powerful movement. We have to focus on the people who are not yet with us. So we're not reaching them by tweeting and Facebook and email, for one. And then two, we have to be clear that there's a difference between an activist and an organic leader. Because if we want to get to scale, what we call the organic leader is this person who has supporters. They're people of influence, but among our ranks, right? I don't mean of influence like presidents and mayors and crap. I mean among ordinary people. There are actually people who influence other people among the grassroots base. So we have to have a very clear model for how we identify them. In the labor movement, we actually have systematic methods for how we identify them and how we distinguish them from activists. So I think that we have to do two things. We have to focus on the undecideds, and we have to have a theory of what the organic leader is, who it is, because that's who we have to focus our education and training work and political education work with, because they themselves then become massive replicators of the work, and they can bring along a ton more people. And if we're confused all the time about, well, what's an activist and what's a leader and what's a, you know, an activist-centric movement, which is what we have right now, isn't working.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, isn't working. And but the conditions for something broader are there because people, I think especially since the crisis, people see what's going on. People identify as working class, as poor, not as middle class or any of this fluff.
Yeah, absolutely.
And there's space, but it's exactly that. We're not reaching.
Yeah, we
people.
Just talk to ourselves all the time, and it makes me flipping mad. I mean, that is why there are a bunch of sort of things that I used to do in my, you know, 20s, getting old now, you know, all sorts of crazy anti-globalization, direct action, da-da-da-da, and I literally just stopped. I'm like, I don't even have time for it anymore because it's all the same people, and we're not winning if all we're doing is talking to all the same people. It looks great. We get so excited. We congratulate ourselves when we have some big direct action. And it adds up to absolutely nothing. And all I want to do is focus on the undecideds.
So maybe we can talk a bit about organizing and talk about a couple of sectors in particular. I mean, this is something I've heard you both talk about and write about as health and education being sort of really key strategic sectors. They're mostly public in Canada. Health is more sort of private in the US. But, you know, with the decline of manufacturing and especially unionized manufacturing, these are some of the really large remaining workplaces. And, you know, as you say, sometimes factory-like even. What's the strategic position of these workers, of these sectors, and how can, you know, the labor movement build sort of strategies around them?
Yeah. I love talking about education and healthcare workers. And I just want to, I mean, I just want to, like, not have people in Canada think you're so damn safe, because I think that the pressures, you know, what we're doing in the U.S. is what we export. Right, we refine it first, and then we kick it up. We kick it north, and we kick it south, and we kick it global. So, just to be clear, I don't know how long your healthcare sector is going to be so public at the rate we're going. Right now, you've got time, so that's good. And obviously, getting rid of Harper is going to help because I think that you could see it under him if he gets in again. It'd be really wild. But anyway, so why these sectors are so strategic, I think, are several. There's several different components to why it's so valuable to focus on healthcare and education. The first is because they actually matter, right? Like having high quality healthcare is a good thing, and having high quality schools, public schools, is a good thing. So I think at even just a strategic base building organizing perspective, they matter a lot. Besides that, they matter to society, right? So from an organizer's view, there's several opportunities that are presented by healthcare workers and by education workers. The first is that they're what I call mission driven. They care a ton about what they're doing. Right, which means that if the employer's putting the squeeze on them, they're going to fight. And we saw them in Chicago, and we've seen that in every single healthcare campaign I've had the pleasure of leading. They may start out as sort of less politicized workers, just like ordinary, you know, people, folks in society. But they will quickly, in my experience, through a good organizing conversation and through a series of campaigns, go through a radical self-discovery and transformation much more quickly in some ways than other workers, given the work that they do, and come to realize that there's a huge crisis in the system, right? So they're mission driven, which means they're going to fight. And then second of all, like strategically, right, they're non-tradable so far, right? Not robots. They haven't completely figured out how to like replace a nurse or a teacher or something with a robot. And they might be trying, but it's going to be a while, despite the rumors, I think. Mm-hmm. And they haven't figured out yet how to offshore it. I mean, they might want to move us to a computer modality system or blah, blah. But, you know, again, we're talking 20 years down the road at least. And what we and what's so important about the stories I like to talk about and write about both from my experience and from watching others, is actually how quickly we can make the kind of transformation I'm talking about.
Yeah.
Chicago Teachers Union, by the way, went from being a piece of crap union that no one wanted anything to do with to a totally transformed, incredible organization in just a few years.
Mm-hmm.
When I went into Nevada to do work there, we had a demoralized, frankly, bad union that workers had no interest in. In 3.5 years, the whole union turned around and organized the entire market, right? So, like, going back to something I think we were talking about earlier, like whenever I talk to climate change activists, who I love just mm-hmm. in my heart, who say to me, no, we don't have time to organize, man, we just got to mobilize, we got to do these campaigns, we got to block things and stop mm-hmm. things, and, you know, the clock is running. It's like, yeah, the clock actually is definitely running, but mm-hmm. there is no shortcut to organizing. And I think what people miss is you can have transformational, huge campaigns and huge change in very little time when we do the work right, when we scale up by focusing on organic leaders, et cetera. So back to why they're so strategic. Again, they're not tradable, right? They're not a tradable commodity, so to speak. We're not going to globalize them out through some pact soon. And then I think the other thing is that they have these incredible organic links to the broader community.
Yeah.
And if the point of organizing is base expansion, which is what I'm arguing it is, right? Mobilizing is something else. The point of good organizing is to expand the base of people who are getting involved in the movement, right? Mobilizing is just getting them off the couch and getting them out. But base expansion is the focus of organizing work. It's not just that in their own workplaces, they're ready to put up a fight as neoliberalism puts more and more and more pressure, right, on them getting their basic job done. It's also that because they have huge links into the community that are really special and organic, they can actually expand the base into the community. And we saw that in Chicago, who took inspiration, by the way, from the British Columbia Federation of Teachers. But the Chicago teachers, in a series of interviews that I did, were very, very clear because of the experiences in British Columbia in 2005 and 6 that they couldn't win without the community. And they invested a lot of front-loaded energy into building really strategic relationships all throughout Chicago. And when that mayor tried to turn the whole community on them, in a way that we see with the attack on public sector workers, with the messaging about, I don't have a pension, I want yours.
Yeah.
He tried to do a version of that with the teachers, right? And it didn't work. And you know why it didn't work in that case? Because they had done really strategic, brilliant, principled work with their communities ahead of time. And they outflanked a very powerful mayor because they were awfully smart about it. So I think we should spend a lot of time in education and healthcare, frankly, in this movement.
And I want to maybe take the flip side of that, which is, I think, to build the kind of conditions that you're talking about, where people will be prepared. And I think that's the real key, that, you know, if you want to have an education strike or health strike, you have to have the community on board. You also have to fight this rhetoric that's, you know, based in some kind of reality of this kind of resentment, whether it's manufactured or not, but people saying, you know, private sector workers, you can say the pay is coming from the boss's pocket, whereas in the public sector, you know, this is my taxes going towards this nurse or this teacher or whatever. How do we fight that, which is the flip side of this, you know, nice rootedness in community?
Yep. And this is a repeat. I mean, I think it's a really good conversation to have. I don't think we're having it enough strategically, but I've definitely been trying to, like, bang on this topic for a couple of years. Because I think even inside of the labor movement in the United States, there's almost an acquiescence to the argument. First of all, I reject the entire concept that there is something called the public sector.
Mm-hmm.
I just reject it. And I reject even more profoundly the concept that there's a private sector. The private sector in the U.S., it's a constructed narrative on the part of corporations and capital, for very strategic reasons, including one we're talking about in terms of divide and conquer, and also because corporations are sucking the taxpayer, you know, they are just sucking taxpayer monies. Like, the subsidies are freaking massive. If you actually look at a so-called private sector corporation and you do a serious, like, full cost accounting, I all the time debate people about this. And it's funny because I got a note, I wrote this in The Nation, and I, you know, I repeat this line all the time. It's like, there is no private sector, there is no public sector. And a bunch of sort of, like, well-known economists who are sort of lefties in the U.S., like, send me emails, like, that is such an important message. How come no one says that? I was like, I don't know. I never got fan mail from economists before, but I felt like I was onto something when I started saying it. They were like, that's right. They're like, there's just the economy. My line is, there's just the economy. So, but again,
it's the socialism for capitalists in the U.S.
Completely. But it's like, again, the point is we have to go through discovery. So here's an example of how we did it. So in Nevada, I do think that there are a lot of important lessons out of the work in Nevada, many of which, you know, we've hit on already and stuff. But one that gets not enough notice is how we took this right on. So when I got to Nevada, the union that the workers had hired me to sort of try and rebuild and build a more powerful union statewide, and very quickly we realized a profound attack was coming on the public sector workers' pension as soon as I got there. Like I thought, I'm going to Nevada because you're going to try and organize some private sector hospitals, right? In a strategic market. Now there was a front page, the newspaper in Nevada is so right wing. It's like Fox News in the daily newspaper. All right. That's how good the newspaper there was. So like I get there, I remember like waking up one morning and one of the first things I see is an editorial cartoon that was actually put on the front page of the daily newspaper that had a photograph of a firefighter trying to put out a fire, holding a hose, and the water was empty. And in the hose was this big bloat and it said firefighter's pension. Oh, like completely blaming the firefighter for nothing, their pension, for not having any water in the hose. Like, okay, casinos, desert, whatever. I mean, there were so many things wrong with that cartoon, but like the fight was on. So I thought we started to hear it in American politics too. Like self-blame by public sector workers a little bit, like we do have too much, one. And then two, as we were going in to begin the campaigns to do the so-called private sector hospital organizing, we would hear it. We would hear the message, the right-wing message coming out of the workers. Like, and so we thought, we actually have to go straight at this. And there was a ballot issue coming. And we thought, what we need to have are the private, quote-unquote, so-called private sector workers, registered nurses, always very popular. We need to have them leading the message about why taxes matter. And so we did a mass educational campaign. We literally created an educational team. We had a PowerPoint. We began to do a bunch of training of key rank-and-file leaders. We had rank-and-file leaders and staff going out and doing road shows. We rolled it out in front of, I think in the first 6 months, we had talked to like 4,000 workers in the union and went straight at the idea. And once we showed people the subsidy level of the so-called private sector and just said to people, this is just a game to take down the last pensions left in America. It's just a strategy on the part of the right. There is no public sector. There is no... Like we literally would take with the nurses in particular, who were very strategic in the campaign once we had done the educational work, we would take a dollar bill. Mm-hmm. We had our researchers actually break down. So we said, for every dollar in your paycheck, just to get the point across. And we showed exactly how much was straight public taxpayer money for Medicaid and Medicare. And then how much was insurance and then how much was so-called private pay. Almost no private pay. And it was like really revolutionary to the healthcare workers that they understood for the first time that their paycheck came from taxes too. So what's all, we were like, right. So what you need is to win the standard that the public sector has. And that's what we're going to do. And we're going to have a campaign to talk about how we're going to do that. And that is what we did. We actually bargained defined benefit pensions in Nevada and said every day of the week, what we want to do proactively is win a contract that looks like what the public sector has. Because that's what every worker in America actually deserves. And a lot more used to have it. So we just, and we basically, we went straight at it. We took it on. We had an educational. We made it real. It wasn't fucking tweeting. It wasn't Facebook. It was like a live, full-on, mass political education with rank-and-file workers about the joke that there's something called the private sector. And it actually worked. And we literally built what we would call an amalgamated union, right? We had so-called private sector and public sector workers who stood up for each other at every turn in that state. We literally just went at the division by doing radical political education.
This is really what I think you're talking about when you're talking about base expansion, that you're really getting something. And like you're saying, that you're going outside of that bubble.
Yeah, and we're not fearing the rhetoric. We're going right at it.
Yeah.
It's like, go right at it. Let's go. I'm going to have that debate with anyone. Like, let's go on the issue of, you know, should we be taking away someone's pension because someone else doesn't have it? No, it's just ridiculous, and we know it is, but we don't go at it like we run away from it because it seems like a hard conversation. Organizing is about having hard conversations. Mm-hmm. Organizing is fundamentally about having hard conversations with people, not running away from hard issues, going straight at them. You can't win a union campaign in an environment in the U.S. unless you go straight at hard conversations. So it's like, this is a really intense, divisive conversation. Let's go straight at it, and let's think carefully and strategically about what the educational tools are that are going to work to do a mass political education campaign on why this is just a bullshit message.
And I think that gets at this distinction between mobilizing and organizing that we were talking about earlier, where that's not what's happening in the sort of social media world or in the sort of mobilization model, because you're sort of just talking to your own people.
That's right.
And it seems really insular, and you're not convincing.
Yeah.
Right. You're not expanding.
Yeah. I mean, it really was a great moment. Like that, just that piece of the work in Nevada. And again, there were a ton of people involved in it. Like we had amazingly smart staff teams. We had amazing rank and file leaders. Like, and it really is what you just said. It was great base expansion. Like we were changing the minds of tens of thousands of people who thought that they were anti-tax or thought they were anti-public sector and realized they were neither.